Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. The Sovereign Military and Hospitaller Order of St. John of Jerusalem, Rhodes and Malta is not only one of the oldest organisations in the Catholic Church, it's also one of the most spiritually and theologically honourable. The order was born through the need to express acts of compassion towards pilgrims who had become vulnerable in their struggle to travel to Jerusalem to honour Jesus and deepen their penitence. The Knights of the Order fought to defend the Church at critical moments in self-defence, for example, during the Battle of Lepanto when the whole of Christian civilization hung in the balance. And they've continued to defend the Church spiritually through acts of prayer, fidelity, humility and chastity. Our guest today is Edmund Adamus. Edmund has just been appointed as the new head of the Formation Centre of the Order, and we talk about the need for a deepening lay Christian spirituality. At its best, the Church has always understood that any renewal of the structures of the Church flows only from the renewal of the individual's heart. And part of his work will be the facilitating of a refreshment of spirit within this visionary and sacrificial lay vocation. He was well qualified, having worked in Catholic education for the last few years, and part of his responsibility has been developing support for Catholic marriage and resourcing the spirituality of parenthood. So in our conversation, we explore the consequences of some of the changes that cultural pressures have imposed on Catholic education. As secularism grows in its antipathy to Catholic and Christian values, so the whole integrity of a shared venture between the state and the Catholic Church is beginning to be called into question. Not for the first time, the Church has to face the implications of trying to work hand in hand with a partner who has turned abusive and aggressive. At the roots of being in this world but not of it is a warning that you cannot serve God and mammon, and judging the point at which the secular state has intractably become an opponent instead of a partner is not an easy call. As Christian parents in the West decide in increasing numbers they are no longer willing to have their children brainwashed rather than educated, the Church is beginning to ask how best it can support parents who decide that the only way they can fulfill their duty to Christ and their responsibility to their children is to go it alone educationally. The development of lay spirituality is not just a matter of deepening the resources of individual Christians. It can also become the mechanism of defending the integrity of the Church from the subversion of its children at the hands of an increasingly aggressive and uncompromising state. Reflecting on these issues, Edmund Adamus joins me now. It's a great pleasure this morning to be able to welcome Edmund Adamus. You've been explaining to me how your name is pronounced both in Polish and in Mancunian. And so I've known you for a while, but as a genial companion on Twitter, liking, correcting, you didn't appear with your own name. You were a fertile heart. Is that because you were presenting yourself as a spokesperson of the organization, in which case can we hear a bit more about it, or because you wanted to preserve your personal anonymity, as so many do on Twitter?
Just before I leap in terms of pronunciation of my name, I was once told in a visit to Ireland that my name in Irish would be O'Gweemish, which is Irish for let us pray. So there we are. Yes, so in answer to your question, I set up the Fertile Heart Twitter account shortly after I was appointed its education consultant in the autumn of 2019. So it's not deliberate anonymity, it's just, you know, representing the thrust and mission of the project on social media. That was one of the aspects of my responsibilities, as, along with other social media platforms, to try and generate interest in the work and in the project, and fundamentally to try and get more schools to become our clients. So that's been one of many challenges, particularly during COVID, as you can imagine, with partial school closures and the impact on it all. So
it must have been very difficult. On Twitter, one quickly developed a nose for Christian orthodoxy and who your friends are and aren't. Could you give us a 90-second potted biography of who you are and how you came to be involved with Fertile Hearts? And then we're going to talk about your new role, your rather exciting role, later on in our conversation.
Gosh, Edmund Adamus in 90 seconds. Wow. Born and bred in Manchester in the mid-60s, youngest of a very large family of eight children, a Polish father, Irish Catholic, British-born mother, so there was no choice of being Catholic. You know, standard education up there. And then in my late teens, discerned a vocation to priesthood I went to seminary at Ushaw College up in Durham, and I trained for the Diocese of Salford. And despite lots of crosses and difficulties, I was eventually ordained for the Diocese of Salford, in ordained deacon in 1989 and priest in 1990. And in the 12 years, I was in active ministry. I was engaged in a whole range of different ministries and apostolates, obviously parish-based ministry, but a lot of higher education ministry, prison, hospital, chaplaincy, and indeed for 4 years as private secretary to then Bishop Patrick Kelly, who became Archbishop of Liverpool, and then Bishop Terence Brain, who was transferred to us from Birmingham in the mid-90s. Long story short, after probably one of the worst and the best of times in my life, I needed time out, wasn't in great shape. And it was in that process of taking some authorized time out, as it were, and lots of retreat and discernment, I felt it was right for me to exit or leave active ministry for a period of time. And that's what brought me to London, not because I was desperately in need of getting away from Manchester, but just to find work. And London seemed to offer the more opportunities to get into something. And so I came to London for a short while, was doing tuition work for children and young adults with special educational needs, kids struggling with hyperlexia, which is the ability to read but not understand or picture what you can read, which is a very interesting. And then I landed a job with the Conference of Religious Secretariat. They were based in Mill Hill then, as a kind of social justice coordinator. And I was with them for about 2 years. And a job came up in the Archdiocese of Westminster for their new pastoral affairs department. So I was appointed as the director for pastoral affairs, which someone once jokingly said to me, "Isn't that what a bishop does?" and it was a huge one-man job. I mean, it was challenging. It was exciting. It was great work managing all of the various social welfare projects around the diocese, alongside coordinating and leading on marriage and family life support. Much of it starting from scratch, like designing and coordinating marriage preparation programs, etc. I did that all through the time that Cardinal Cormack was Archbishop, God rest him. And then about a year or so after Archbishop Vincent came in 2009, he asked me to process manage the beginnings and the establishment of Caritas Westminster, which I undertook. And at the end of that, it was a very peculiar time, because the more I worked hard on that project and the more it looked like it was going to be very fruitful and succeed, the more I thought, oh, I'm actually putting myself out of a job here. It's a very, very strange paradox to live through. And indeed, they did decide to openly recruit. So it was very stressful. But to his credit, Cardinal Vincent specifically asked me to be full-time director for marriage and family life in 2012, which I was more than happy to take on, not just to pay the mortgage, but actually it's where my passions really lay, I think, in the whole area of pastoral care of marriage and the family in those days, a la Familiaris Consortio, and the vision of John Paul II for theology of the body and Christian anthropology, etc. So that's what I did from 2012 right up to 2016. And then I was headhunted by the Diocese of Portsmouth to become their Diocesan Schools Commissioner, or probably what's one of the longest titles in ecclesiastical history, which was Professional Advisor to the Episcopal Vicar for Education. And I did that job for 3 years, and then very sadly and suddenly the role was made redundant in 2019. And then I was offered work with the Fertile Heart Project, who I'd already come to know about because I'd been promoting authentic relationships and sexuality formation resources for Catholic schools anyway, and they knew me. So they said, look, you know, we need someone to become a consultant for us to help develop and refine our content, but also to promote and market what we offer to schools to get more schools to take on, to use the resources. So I was delighted and glad to take that role on. It was working from home, which was obviously more family friendly. I started that in the October of 2019. And then, of course, you know, COVID came along in the following March. And as many people can say, the rest is history. It's been a really tough uphill struggle. since then, and my work really didn't bounce back, you know, from furlough and all of that kind of stuff. So I've been mostly part-time in that. And then last October, a very good friend of mine, who is a member here in Britain of the Sovereign Order of Malta, he'd been very kind and concerned about my job searches and my seeking opportunities for new work. And he said, look, I've just had this email from that goes around to members, and they're looking for someone who'll be the head of a formation center in Rome. And there wasn't a very detailed job description. It was just, you know, broad headlines of what they were looking for. And he said, I think you'd be great at that. And I thought, okay. So I just sent in my CV, and they said, oh, that's very interesting. You'll hear from our recruitment agency, which I did just before the Christmas. Had a kind of screening interview with that agency based in Rome. And then the following January had a more fuller interview with two senior members, what's called the Government Council of the Order. And then April, just after Easter, I think it was, I was asked to come to Rome for a fuller interview with the Grand Chancellor, Albrecht von Boeslager. And I met him in Rome and had an interview with him and the lady who is in charge of HR. And a week later, they said, we want to offer you the job.
I'd like to go back in a moment and talk about Catholic education and John Paul II's Theology of the Order. But let's stick with the Order of Malta for the moment, because we're there and you're about to take this job up. We're attracting some non-Catholic listeners, I'm pleased to say. Some of them won't know what the Order of Malta is. Can you do your 90-second synopsis?
So the Order of Malta is over 900 years old, a lay religious order within the Catholic Church, unique in that sense, that they have prelates and priests who are members of the order by virtue of them being chaplains, but the members of the order are lay, and those at the very top, if you like, the ones who've been what they call the grand masters, have always been what they call fully professed knights. They have taken vows of poverty, chastity, and obedience, and their lives are fully committed to the charitable works and governance of the order. But its origins go back to the Crusades in the 11th century, and it was founded to alleviate the suffering and difficulties of pilgrims who'd come to Jerusalem and needed nursing care or even medical care, because they'd finally got there, they were, you know, not in great shape, many of them. And a hospital was built, a hospice, a care place was built. Even then, back in the 11th century, no expense was spared to give these sick pilgrims the best possible accommodation and bed linen and medical care. The order has kind of excelled in whatever charitable work it decides to do for the sick and the poor has to be of the best quality, the best standard. And so its history has been a long one, to say the least, and they had to leave Jerusalem when they were kind of forced out by those wars, and then they kind of relocated to Rhodes. Again, a similar situation. They were forced out and by force of arms. Finally found themselves in Malta, where after, I think it was something like a three-month siege, because they were knights. They were, you know, military knights, as well as being committed Catholic men. They finally won that siege, and it was his name was Valette, hence Valletta, the capital of Malta. And so that has become, over time, their historical location. And then I think it was in the 18th century, so the mid-1750s, something like that, they acquired property in Rome, both in terms of the Palazzo di Malta, which is on the Via Condotti near the Spanish Steps, which is their central kind of magistracy, as they call it, their grand magistracy, and they have a villa on the Aventine Hill. Unlike any Catholic religious order, the Sovereign Order of Malta is the sovereign military order of Malta, because it's a sovereign entity in its own right, much like the Vatican is its own territorial entity. So too the Palazzo di Malta. They have that status across the world and UN observer status because they have diplomatic relations with, I think, 112 countries. So it's an extraordinary organization that has a global humanitarian outreach.
So it's ancient, it's exotic, it's unique, it's valuable, and it has a vocation for charity, for agape, for compassion. What you and I were talking about the relationship between any organization which has to get its constitution right and spiritual renewal. What does spiritual renewal look like in an organization that, at least in terms of its inherited genes, seems to have everything you would want?
The charisms that they cherish, as any religious order would and should, they cherish highly their charism, which is fidelity to the truths of the faith and unconditional service to the poor and the sick. They have from their founder this idea that when we talk about the sick and the poor, we talk about our lords, the sick and the poor. So there's this idea that although it's historically a chivalric order, you know, people who came from nobility and aristocracy, no matter how high your family pedigree, you had to roll up your sleeves and get your hands dirty, as it were, looking after the sick and the poor and the lame, because Christ is in those sick and poor and lame, and get down on your knees and serve them, just as, you know, Jesus showed us in the Last Supper and throughout his life. So the charism is really very simple in its truth. But obviously that to discern who the sick and the poor are in each era of history is a constant call to mission and call to holiness. And you can't do that unless you're saying your prayers. You can't do that. You can't discern unless you are serious and conscientious about what motivates you to live that charism. And so in addition to, if you like, the traditional spirituality of fidelity to a sacramental life, Marian devotion, they're very, very committed to pilgrimage. There's a huge, huge annual pilgrimage to Lourdes, the beginning of May every year, but each national association will have its own devotions and pilgrimages and spiritual retreats and what have you. There's been some really hard, long thinking and reflecting within the leadership of the order, but also within the membership of the order, about, you know, how can we deepen our life in Christ whilst remaining faithful to our specific charism and have a fresh, dynamic outreach to the world of today.
Presumably, you have something important to offer too. I think one of the great theological questions of our time for the church, which I've tried to express in Ashenden's first law of metaphysics, which is that there's an inverse proportional relationship between your authentic life in the spirit and your political activism. In other words, the less authentically you pray and repent, the more you're going to be tempted to get into politics, because it's a congenial way of feeling useful. Whereas the life of the spirit is that nothing is more useful than prayer and worship, and everything flows from it. And in the way in which you've been describing the Order of Malta, it sounds as though they have that right and are less likely to slip into the liberation theology temptation, which is essentially we need to try and reorganize the structures of political and social society to make it more like what we think heaven is going to be. So the works of charity that you're talking about are, it sounds as though the Order has avoided the temptation to bring about political change, but instead is trying to make a link between compassion and prayer. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. I would say in terms of its mission, absolutely. Its work in diplomacy, which underpins that mission wherever in the world, even that work, which of course by its nature will involve engaging in dialogue with, you know, politicians and the like, and nevertheless probably approaches it with the spirit of being the leaven, being salt and light to the earth, as it were, being that authentic Catholic Christian presence, even in the corridors of power, or wherever that might be, to effect positive change, etc. I think that the fundamental grasp it has of its own identity, because it's been around for such a long time, is really solid. And I always think it's probably embodies that teaching that I think it was Pope Benedict XVI articulated so very well some time ago, and it may be in Caritas in Veritate, I can't remember, but certainly I've read it somewhere, where he talked about, you know, if Catholic charity in whatever organization around the world, with all of the great work it's doing, if that isn't being performed with a very strong sense of serving Christ in others, and therefore building up the kingdom, then it's just, the church isn't a glorified NGO. It's not evangelization. And I think the order, like many organizations within the church that's involved in charitable activity to the poor and needy, takes that very seriously, that yes, we help people materially, we ameliorate the suffering through very practical means, whoever that person may be, regardless of faith or no faith, but it's the spirit in which it's performed, that it the love and care that is displayed to those in need is done in such a way that in and of itself, it's a form of evangelization, because you are making the presence of Christ's loving care and touch in the world more visibly known and felt. But as I said earlier, you can't recognize and realize that purpose unless it's underpinned with a very strong spiritual stream of prayer, spirituality, etc. The components of which, as you can imagine, are hugely varied and diverse, and it will be my privilege, along with many others, to enhance that and enrich that diversity and provision that's already there and make it even stronger, hopefully.
And so it sounds as though between the two poles of disengaged piety and enthusiastic political activism, the order stands for a fusion of both, with the priority to spirituality out of which flows the caritas that you're talking about.
Absolutely. And one of the things that took place in, I think it was April 2020, one of the former Grand Masters who sadly passed away in the autumn of 2020, obviously this must have been discussed and in agreement with other leaders, and the order was solemnly consecrated to the Sacred Heart of Jesus and the Immaculate Heart of Mary by way of a seal on this long discussion and dialogue that had taken place amongst the leadership about new energies coming to spiritual renewal. I think it's a really beautiful thing and something to really value and treasure, that this, the continuation of the order, if you like, but also it's the desire amongst its members for a deeper spiritual life has been placed under such beautiful heavenly patronage and consecration. Not just a one-off thing, you know, that the members are invited to pray that prayer of consecration as part of their own prayer life as frequently as possible. So it's an ongoing consecration within the life of its members, which I think is tremendous.
So can we extend this to your work in marriage? Because it seems to me they're obviously linked. You're talking about reinvigorating lay vocation and lay spirituality. And most Catholics are lay, of course. You know, for a long time, there's always been the potential to see celibacy and the priesthood as not only different, but superior. But there's always needed to be a renewal of the vocation of marriage and family life within the church, or else there isn't a church. How difficult did you find it to promote a hunger for renewing and strengthening married life, and particularly for developing an overt piety that could be recognized and treasured in the church?
Well, it's just a huge topic, isn't it? And the last three popes, including Pope Francis, no one can say they haven't drawn our attention to this massively important call to holiness of marriage and family life, amidst all of the continued pressures and challenges that face the very identity and core identity of what marriage is and what parenthood is. And yet, the perennial truths of marriage, of man and woman open to life, for life, being a central pillar in God's plan for humanity, is just, it's not going away. it is what it is. I often used to, when I was talking to engaged couples and couples who are on retreat with our programs in Westminster, I often used to say, spouses are the priests of the domestic church. And that's something that comes from St. Thomas Aquinas, and it's enunciated by John Paul II in Familiaris Consortio. And if that's true, and we believe it to be true, because there is a sacrificial, victimal, ministerial offering of spouse to each other, spouses to each other, in the image of Christ's sacrifice for his bride, the church, on Calvary. If spouses are the priests of the domestic church, then parents are the bishops of the domestic church. Because however many children you have, whether it's one child or a large family, you know, each child is a soul. And as St. Augustine once famously said, you know, one soul is a big enough diocese for any bishop. That's not to be glib about it, because actually it's something very strong in the patristics. John Chrysostom and others went into this in great detail. Augustine himself, after the death of St. Monica, when he was reflecting on the influence of his mother's life on his own journey into Christ, he said something like, I now realize that the responsibilities and duties of a Christian parent are like unto a bishopric.
The family is like a nano parish, a micro parish.
A micro parish, micro diocese.
With clergy and episcopal responsibilities. That's very beautiful and very powerful.
And I think, you know, before we came on air, as it were, you were talking about, you know, it's so important to somehow capture the imagination of people, particularly parents, to re-engage with the formation and education of their children with a new joie de vivre, a new sense of vigor. And I think for those who are serious about their Christian identity as parents, this leitmotif of parenthood being, you know, like unto the spiritual pastoral responsibilities of a bishop, for which you will one day answer for, I think is a way of capturing the imagination, but also propelling people forward to be bold and to be brave and say, actually, okay, I may have zero spiritual or theological formation or know-how, because, you know, that's not my professional background and training, but God has given me this child or these children for a purpose and a reason. And you only have them for a season. You know, life is very short. And the formational window of opportunity you have to transmit the faith to a child through to adolescence into young adulthood, as you will know yourself, is a very short space of time.
It is. It's very intense.
And you've got to lead in that role. Propose always, every day, never impose. And it's a delicate balance to strike when you're a parent and kids push back and all of that kind of stuff. But to come at it with greater seriousness and intent, to be intentional about your Christian parenting, that is more needed than ever before, I think.
I think the vision of Aquinas of the family as a microdiocese is a very powerful one and inspirational, and particularly important now, because with your educational hat on, can I ask you what you think about the crisis we have in our culture? It seems to me that Catholic education in this country is obviously becoming more and more circumscribed. The John Fisher episode a month or so ago reminded us that there are points of value divergence which can become very serious political crises in the life of a society. And it looks as though some of this divergence is about to be stressed to a point of breaking. In America, there's an increasing movement of parents taking responsibility for educating their children in part or in whole. What do you see happening as the present situation develops and the gap between what's allowed in the secular space and the Catholic vocation to Christianity diverges and widens to the point where there may be some form of breach? There aren't enough Catholic teachers. Catholic values are in direct antipathy to the whole diversity inclusion agenda. How are parents going to be asked to step into that gap, and could it be a virtuous thing?
It's a huge question. It really is. And these flashpoints that we see, you know, of controversy, you know, in particular schools or in dioceses, not just here in England and Wales, but, you know, in other parts of the world, that, as you say, they're indicators of just how accentuated all these tensions are. It's interesting. I think, I can't remember the exact location. It's said in the document Amoris Laetitia, you know, the joy of love, by Pope Francis, the post-synodal exhortation on the family. And he talks about, you know, the importance of the role of education, educators in the formation of young people and children. But he is honest about the strain in the relationship between a teacher and parent, school and home. In fact, he the words he uses are something like, the educational relationship is in crisis. I remember when reading it, I thought, I'm good he said that, because it, you know, it's naming the elephant in the room. Yes, there are, by and large, tremendous spirit of collaboration, as there should and ought to be, between Catholic schools and parents. But all too often and on many occasions, the trust has broken down. And we've seen that trust not just broken down, but bitterly betrayed on the part of schools and school leadership all too often towards parents' rights and responsibilities, particularly in the area of so-called relationships and sex education, or what people, you know, ordinarily refer to as sex education. To be fair, we've not talked about sex education for quite a long time. Even the government hasn't used that descriptor for some time, and now it's relationship, sex and health education. I prefer to talk about relationships and sexuality formation, because education is too much about, you know, filling the head with knowledge. You know, and Pope Francis says, you know, when we're talking about the formation of young people in a healthy, wholesome human sexuality enlightened by Christ, then it's got to be more than just filling their heads with data. It's got to be formation of the whole person. And you can't even begin to do that as an educator or as a school or an institution unless you fully embrace that you are in a loco parentis and you are there to support primarily, not exclusively, but primarily the rights and duties of parents to have their children formed and shaped and educated in the Catholic Christian values, particularly in relation to human sexuality.
There's one thing about being in loco parentis, is another thing when loco parentis becomes contra parentis, and as our whole society slips to the left, and we know perfectly well that the left's ambitions appear to express themselves by replacing the rights of the parents with the ambitions of the state, there comes a point where the ambitions of the state and the rights and preferences of the parents are in direct conflict. It seems to me we've got to that point now.
Yeah, and that view has been around a long time. You know, I think there was an article published in the Times way as far back as 1974, when Lady Helen Brooke said, "Parents, the new enemies of the state."
Yeah,
that's seeped into the institutional culture, almost all infrastructure of our society, not just education, but social services, NHS, everything is, let's keep parents not just at arm's length because they get in the way of our agenda, but actually we must put all and every obstacle we can in front of parents. It's almost like a cultish approach, you know, to steal young people away from their parents so that the values of the elders, if you like, can't be imbibed by the next generation. And we see the devastation all around. And yet, because the family of its nature is divinely instituted, and this includes those families who may have no faith whatsoever, but because their unit is based on natural law, natural justice, divine truth will still speak through those relationships and the truth and authenticity of those relationships. With great difficulty when all around us are against the family, but nevertheless, the truth of authentic, loving parent-child relationship, spousal relationship, will win the day. But you are right to allude to the fact that, and we're seeing more of this in America, that more and more parents are, as the saying goes, doing it for themselves. That's no bad thing. Whatever the rights and wrongs or the pros and cons of the homeschooling movement or the home educating movement. It's tiny in this country, but huge in America. I think there's something like over 5 million children now in the States are homeschooled. I think as a movement, it will be a vehicle by which even for many who don't, for whatever reasons and legitimate reasons, don't choose to homeschool their children, will be energized again about their moral power and authority as parents to shape and form the heart and consciences of their own children, because there's this instinctual sense that they're answerable for it to God because they are their children, no one else's children.
I think I won't be the only person listening to this conversation who's been very moved and inspired by your articulating a piece of Aquinas I hadn't yet come across. I'm sorry to have asked you to answer such enormous questions in such a brief span of time. Thank you so much for coming on and doing it. And I think you've raised the mark of any good conversation is that it raises as many questions as it answers. So thank you for doing that. When do you start your new post?
I officially start on the 1st of July. I'll still have a role in the Fertile Heart Project. I'll still be supporting it, perhaps a little bit on the sidelines, but I'll still be involved because it's such an important, urgent apostolate, and I don't want to just, you know, walk away from that. And so that's fine. It's going to be a very, very interesting summer.
For those who like to keep their Twitter friends close, what's your new Twitter handle going to be? Deus Levult or something? How are we going to keep in touch with
you? Well, I'll still be involved in the Fertile Heart social media presence. I think not to the degree I have been, but I'll probably keep an eye on that. So I'll still be available there. Thankfully, I won't be responsible for any kind of social media activity in the order that they have a fantastic, really fantastic communications department and communications team, which have done incredible work over the last two decades, and it's really sharp, up-to-date, fresh presence there on the digital continent, to use a phrase of Pope Benedict's. So in a way, I'm kind of quite relieved I don't have any kind of remit to be on the internet every day. I can just actually do a deep dive into the really meaty and important stuff, which is helping people enrich their and enhance their vocation at service of the poor and the truth of the faith. So it's going to be a fascinating. So pray for me.
Edmund, thank you for starting your journey in reaching out to the whole rest of the world through the Catholic Herald podcast, Merely Catholic. It's been great. It's been great to have you on the show, and we're very grateful. God bless you in your new work.
Thank you, Vavin. Bless you too.